This is Hacker Public Radio episode 3376 for Monday, the 12th of July 2021. Today's show is entitled, Making Books with Linux, Part 2. It is hosted by Dave Morris, and is about 49 minutes long, and carries an explicit flag. The summary is, Part 2 of a discussion about how 2 HPR hosts create books.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Hacker Public Radio. I am Andrew, also known as McNallu, and I'm joined today by Dave. How are you doing,
Andrew? I'm great, thanks. It's a lovely day in Edinburgh, and I believe it's a very nice day in Glasgow as well.
Yes, so, I'm sitting here in the dark looking out at the bright sunshine. And I should also mention that if you listen carefully, we'll have other guests, mainly a great tit, which is outside. If you listen carefully, you might hear him chirping away.
Yeah, the bird sound is not so bad here because I've shut the door. But if I were to leave the door open, the back door open, you would hear lots of sparrows and starlings and everything. So, yeah, I think it's good. I like the ambient the qualities of these things, you know, the background noises and stuff, but sometimes yeah. It's not appropriate.
No, I think it's quite pleasant today, and it's not fake. It is real birdsong that you might hear in the background, but knowing them, they probably all shut up now we started recording. So what we're going to talk about today is, well, this is sort of loosely connected to a show that we recorded a week ago. I don't know how far apart they'll be separated when they're released, but last time when Dave and I talked, he was quizzing me and I was talking about some document creation scripts and methods that I had used. And so we're now switching roles. You're going to hear less from me and more from Dave on some interesting ideas and scripts that he has been developing for cataloging HPR, making notes in HPR episodes. Would that be a fair summary?
Yes. It's the principle behind this is that I have developed a mindset that says I'm not very good at remembering things and getting things done in order and stuff like that. So I like to write either recipes, a bit of paper that says do this in this order, or I write bits of code to do it. And that's what I've done in the HBR case, you know, so I don't suddenly forget, oh no, forgot to put tags on that show. Oh no, that's terrible. And that sort of thing. I'll try and make them up on the fly and stuff. So I have scripts which do a lot of what I need to do to make an HBR show, which I also use I've got a similar set that I use when people send shows into HBR, and particularly when people send in shows with pictures, which I encourage, pictures and, you know, bits of code or whatever that is they're sending in, much to be encouraged, but it takes a bit of management when it comes in as a text file with possibly not even intending it to be Markdown, so it needs to be turned into Markdown and the pictures all stitched into it or whatever. And I've written scripts to do that as well. So as you do, you know.
Yes, indeed. In fact, I've sought your advice on how best to do that as a contributor as well. I recall.
Yes.
I can't remember whether I got it right or not. You're too polite to say, I think, but I tried to do my best to minimise your work. And
I haven't yet made a definitive document of any sort. I'm in the process of putting one together that says, if you're sending in what I call assets with your, just because I wanted a word, and that seemed like an appropriate one, with your show, then could you please do it in this sort of way? And then my scripts and stuff can easily sort it out, and then I can do a bit of automation of sticking the links and so forth into the show.
And actually, before we go into the details of your scripts, is it worth maybe just briefly describing the format of show notes with images that you would prefer? I mean, how would you, some show notes arrived and they're all neatly done in Markdown, and somebody has included an image in the show notes and uploaded an image with their show, what structure would you like to see in the Markdown, ideally, that would make you go, oh, good, this is no work for me?
Well, it's fairly simple, actually, if all those things that you just said are true. Because Markdown has the capability of referencing an image, it can be relatively straightforward to simply, you just need to know the URL of where your picture will go. And we do, it's pretty obscure, but it is in the documentation. What we do is we have a directory where all the shows go, all the audio goes. The actual notes are in a database. So if we have assets, if you don't mind me using that term, then we create a subdirectory which is named HPR1234, whatever your show number is. And in it, we put the various extras and stuff. Ideally, we want you to put an index in that directory, because the way that the web server set up on the HPR machine, that server, is that if you have a directory and you don't want people to browse it, you need to put an index.html file in there. So yeah, it's not that simple, actually, now I come to say it. But given that you know that your picture is going to be, you know, the HPR site / blah, 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 / HPR so-and-so, so-and-so, then the name of your picture, .jpg or .png or whatever it is, then you could put that all together and make it so. However, most people don't send in that level of Markdown. There are some people who do a brilliant job. Some people who send in what we originally asked for, which is HTML. But you know, getting the links right in that can be quite daunting. Mm. So what people tend to do, and this is something that sort of evolved really, is that they say they write their text not in Markdown but just in plain text. But plain text and Markdown, at the base level, are pretty similar, aren't they? The way people lay out text, you know, you might put a header in as a separate line, and you might make a list by putting a hyphen at the start of each line, and so forth. So if they send it in with some sort of meta thing in it that says picture one here please, or something like that, Dave, could I have picture one in this place, or something like that. It won't always be me, but you know what I'm saying, that something that makes it plain that here is where picture one is to go. Right. Then I can actually turn that into a thing which I can turn into Markdown with the links in, and I can compute where they're going to be and get the order from your order and so forth. So that's where we are at the moment. Does that make sense?
Yes, that does. That does make sense. Yeah, that's fine. So anyway, so that was a bit of a digression that I threw in there. So what is it specifically that you'd like to talk about with the work that you've been doing?
Well, it's two things really. There's the whole infrastructure of how I found it useful to put together notes for HBR, and there's also what I'm trying to do in terms of a book. Though I'd call it a book is a bit highfalutin, really. It's a consolidated number of show notes in a more readable form. That's where we started from, really, when we were talking about this, but we've sort of gone into the area of HPR show notes a little bit, which is, I think quite relevant and interesting, hopefully, anyway. So if I mention what I do with show notes in a general sense, I have found that it makes life a lot easier for me if I intersperse my notes with a sort of another markup thing. For years and years and years, I've been using a Perl tool, and there's equivalents called Template Toolkit. It's what do you call these things? It's a templating system, I suppose, is what you call it. They exist for all sorts of languages, and independently of languages, I think, as well. The principle of it is that you put a tagged item into your text, which is seen by something that pre-processes it. So the pre-processing would go through the file and say, oh, look, here's one of my tags. What am I to do? And in some cases, it's merely a variable being created, or it could be code being created. There's all manner of capabilities that exist in there. And what I often do is to make these template variables to contain long convoluted URLs, and I put them all at the top of the document. And then when I come to make a link to that URL, or there's in Markdown, there tends to be two cases where you want to make links. One is if you are just making a list of links to things. It's part, the URL part is where you put your URL, but there's also a thing where you might want to put things which are they called references? I think they are, where you say, you know, in document ABC, and then you put in square brackets a number after it. This is in Markdown. And then what happens is that the word gets highlighted and a link is made to an item that you put at the end of your Markdown document, tagged with that number, or anything actually, but in there you have to have the URL. So because I know I would screw up the writing the URL the first time and then the second time and so on, I make template variables to hold it, and then I can just put the template language to allow the item to be inserted.
Yes, that makes sense. I've used something, well, I didn't use it, but there's something similar going on behind Pelican, which is written in Python. It has, mm-hmm. I forget what it's called now, but yes, and I know that the Ruby equivalent of Pelican uses something similar.
Yeah.
What's the one that you're using? Did you say? Maybe I missed the name.
It's called Template Toolkit. It's usually referred to as TT2, and it's also, there's also a Python version of it now. That's it came from Perl originally, and it's used. It was originally used to enable you to make generic HTML. So, you know, you'd write a piece of HTML that said, put the footer here, put the header here, the footer here, put the body here. And then those things would be references to other files, which just got pasted in at the time that the processor processed it. You know, it would work for static pages as well, you know, but it could be used for dynamic pages as you saw fit. So that's where that sort of stuff came from, and loads of other people have known. It's in PHP, it's in all sorts of languages, that style of idea.
Yes, I think it's either called Pigments or Ginger 2, so mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The Python one, the Python templating one. I've never used it, but I just noticed it as a dependency when I was compiling Pelican once.
I used to use it at work quite a lot because we serviced the mailing list feature. We ran Mailman eventually, so we offered a mailing list feature that there were mailing lists that sent messages to all students and all staff and that sort of thing, but there were also the capability of people, members of staff at the university, to request a mailing list to go to their research group or whatever. And we created a form that they needed to fill in on the web, which sent a standardized request in, and then I wrote things that took those forms and did the necessary, and also sent back a boilerplate mail reply. Sometimes it said, you know, I just made it simple so you could just say, send boilerplate, go away, or something. You're not authorized to have a mailing list, or the boilerplate, which said, yeah, done it. This is all done with just sort of command line scripts that let you take a mail message, chop it up into pieces, rebuild it through the template with boilerplate stuff and so forth. And so I found that Template Toolkit was fantastic for that sort of thing, because you could make umpteen different, you just have one script, and then you just told the script, use this template, and that caused it to do one thing, and this template made it do another thing. You know? So it's remarkably useful for all sorts of things like that.
All right. Yes, I didn't realize this seems to be the ancestor of the things I'd come across. I didn't realize it went quite so far back as that.
Yeah, it's. I think I was probably playing with this in the early 2000s, that sort of timescale, when Perl really was the language that you did all this sort of stuff in. But yeah, it's very convenient. I find myself writing scripts of a general nature these days where I put a template capability into it. So if I want a report out of it or something, then I can just say run against this template, and it just throws whatever data structure it's got, and out comes a form which might be HTML or CSV or anything you like, depending on how you've written the template. The work is done in the template. But you're just throwing it a bunch of data. I mean, I'm sure you're well aware of how this sort of stuff works, but just in case people are not fully up to speed with this type of stuff, it's a fun way of doing things.
Yeah, no, it's definitely worthwhile explaining that, because actually I'm not that familiar with it, for starters. And secondly, sometimes, you know, when you listen to HPR shows, somebody mentions something as if everyone's going to understand it. Oh, that sounds interesting, but I don't understand it. And of course, we know that Ken would be there, do a show.
yes. These templating systems are quite good. The template toolkit that I know the best has got the ability to, there's loads and loads of plugins, for example. So you can, if you wish, put the database plugin into it. So within your template, you can do database queries, and you can, and then format those queries into Markdown in a document, which then gets printed in a pretty form, or as pretty as you can do with Markdown, which has a few limitations in that sort of area. But, it's just really convenient to be able to do that sort of stuff. I develop my show note creation stuff where I often do shows about how to do things in Bash or whatever, and then I do some example scripts, Bash scripts. And what I do is to have the Bash script available to the infrastructure that creates the notes, and I can put a reference in the template that says, at this point, run the script, or show the script maybe as part of the text, and then run the script and show the output from the script. So that's a couple of template calls. There's a macro type facility which lets you make external calls and that type of thing. So that has been amazingly useful, because if you're ever doing things where you're running a script and showing the output, the tendency to tweak that script, forget to put the tweak into the notes and then put the output, and then you look at it and think, how on earth did that script ever produce that output? Well, I do anyway. But if it was the script itself that made the output, then it's a lot easier. I mean, my son's doing this MSc in computer science, and they use Jupyter Notebooks. Is it Jupyter Notebooks? Yeah, quite a lot, which has that principle in it, that you can put your, I think they have to submit their work sometimes with their program that they've written in the notebook with the output, which I think the reader can just run and see what it does. So you know, it's a, what I've done is very basic in comparison to the way the world has moved to do these types of things. But it's just a, you know, fun thing.
Yes, yeah, yeah. It's actually a friend of mine introduced me to the Jupyter Notebook stuff, which is a Python thing, isn't it?
Yes, I believe so.
Yes, and I was like, just checking out, remembering the right thing, and I was quite impressed with that and the little models he was building, and it was all very easy for me to inspect and fiddle around with.
Yeah, I think so. I think I went to a talk given by the Edinburgh Linux User Group a couple of years ago now. Wow, time's flown, isn't it? But the guy who was managing the Edinburgh University Jupyter Notebooks engine for Edinburgh and a whole bunch of other universities, I think, as a service, was there talking about, you know, the sort of things he was being asked to do. So you can build notebooks for different languages and this type of thing. It's incredibly impressive.
Indeed, yes. So so when I mean, what is it you're hoping to have produced when you get to the end of this, if you're or is it just a sort of long ongoing task?
The production of HBR show notes has been through a long development, where the goal was simply to make something that I could use and fairly resilient to the daft lad going and running it wrongly, and so me being the daft lad, of course, which I've more or less achieved, actually. So I do things like I start writing some notes, and in the majority of shows that I produce, I make a long set of notes, which is pages and pages sometimes, and separate that from the notes you see when you actually bring up the show on HBR. The you just get an overview in the short form of it. So I start by writing the long thing, and because the way I've built the template, it auto-generates the short stuff as it goes, you know. So there's as long as you type your overview in a pre-assigned block. Sorry, my chair is very creaky today.
That's okay.
It's better than the birds. No, I prefer the birds, actually. so long as you put the overview in the right place or you put your links in the right place, then you end up with an overview and links in the short notes, and you don't have to do anything to it. In fact, if I do something to it, then I'll break it probably. So things like that I do. And I also determine what files are going to be associated with the thing, and that's a sort of incrementing process, so that I've decided, right, I'm going to have a script here which demonstrates that feature I've been talking about, and then and it's some examples that run and produce output to prove that it does what it's going to do. So I would put those together and put them in a place where the software can find it. Each of my shows has its own directory associated with it. And then I make a sort of parts list, manifest, whatever you like to call it, which just has the paths to the various files. And then I've written a preprocessor that goes through all of this stuff and feeds the template. The template then generates Markdown, and the Markdown's given to Pandoc, and out comes HTML with all of this stuff hopefully stitched into it. So, and incidentally, you were saying about monitoring the development of a program, of a text, I mean. You were using ENTR, how are you supposed to pronounce that?
Yes, that's right.
So you told me about that years ago, actually, and yeah. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I was just going to say that you've recently suggested a better alternative, because I was using Meduri, because you could instruct Meduri to page refresh, which you couldn't do with Chrome and Firefox and other browsers that I could interact with in the command line. And then I could use enter to trigger the page, Meduri, to do its page refresh. So I could literally type in the Markdown file as soon as I saved it, Enter would pick that up and tell Moduri to fire a page refresh. Mm-hmm. So I would, mm-hmm. you know, every time I saved it, I would get an instant preview. But was it the Falcon browser you yes. said can do both yes. of those together?
Falcon doesn't need to be told. It seems to monitor, and whether it's only files, I don't know, because, you know, I've, in my case, I will have created a file in my file system that contains the HTML that I'm going to send to HBR. And Falcon just says, oh, it's changed, right? And then it just refreshes it as it changes. So it's doing something like what Enter is doing all by itself, which is, I don't know whether you can turn it on or off, but it's on by default with me. It's really good.
Yeah, and Falcon, it's spelt with a K. The clue being that it's I think when we in TuxJam, we reviewed Chaos, and then that's when you prompted you to mention Falcon, because this Falcon was included with Chaos. So the K is an indication that it's part of KDE. Is that
yeah,
right?
I think so. It's I'm not sure what it derives from. One of the well-known browsers, I think it offers sort of better tab management. You remember how I think Chrome and Firefox had really fancy capabilities that let you have lots and lots of tabs that you could go and group together and go back and fish around with them. Then they took all that out, which I missed enormously, because managing tabs was a great thing for, as far as I was concerned. I think Falcon's got some of that in it. So, you know, it's relatively easy to manage the things that you're working with through Falcon, which is good.
Yeah. Well, I was just looking, because I assumed, I assumed that Falcon replaced Conqueror, which is the browser that KDE has used for as long as I've used KDE, since KDE 3. Something or other. But in my Slackware, which has KDE with Plasma 5, I still have Conqueror, but that may be because I haven't actually removed old packages. So, but Falcon is there, and I hadn't noticed. So Falcon must have appeared when Plasma 5 came in Slackware. And it says that it's a Qt web browser previously known as Qupzilla, Q-U-P, Zilla. Qt web engine for rendering. So it's distinct then from both Chrome and Firefox. It's separate to that then.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, I'd forgotten that. I'm confused because I've got so many browsers I fiddle around with. Yeah. And it doesn't have quite the powerful features of tab grouping that some do, but you know that's by the by, really.
Yes, and well, I mean, the fact that I've already got it installed means in future I'll be using Falcon to do this job, because it replaces both Enter and Moduri, neither of which I believe come with Slackware. I had to compile them myself, which wasn't, both were very easy, to be honest. But if I've already got Falcon to do the job, I might as well just use that from now on.
Yeah, see how you get on with it. It might not contain all the browser features that you want. I mainly use it to point at HTML files that I'm developing, but it seems to be great for that. It's very responsive, and it's got pretty much everything I want, so hopefully the same with you.
Yeah. Oh, actually, now I say that, I would still have to use Enter, because the other thing Enter will do is fire the script that turns the markdown into HTML, so Falcon can't do that, but it's got some kind of it's clever hook in it.
I don't know.
I'll go and read, because if it can do, you never know.
I think I said last time we spoke that I use Make to do that. So Make spots that there is work to do. If I run Make out of Vim, so I do something like Make all, and it just goes and says, oh, you've updated your notes. I will just go, oh, and that, those notes as well, you know the usual stuff, and it's got rules for doing all the pan docking and putting through template engines and all that sort of stuff. So that's quite, I actually made it, I haven't quite got to the point where it uploads the show yet, but That would be my ultimate goal. I don't think Ken would be too pleased if I did that, though.
Yes, yeah.
My original Bash script, which I was going to share with the world, did do that because it could use FTP to upload stuff. But now we've got a form. I could obviously write to the form with curl or something, but I have never got around to developing it because you can't really poke around to somebody's form to develop your automation behind the scenes without causing a fair amount of grief, I would have thought.
Yes, I suppose one thing that could be done is, rather than using curl the way you described, another way to do it is create some kind of rudimentary API on the HPR website so people, because the community is the kind of community that would like, so I'm sure many, I would do it. I would like to submit my shows through an API. That would work fine.
Yeah, it has been discussed, actually. It has been discussed. I'm not sure how far we've got with it. I think we suffer from failing to develop in the sort of way that you'd like, because everybody's so busy doing their own, having their own lives and doing their own jobs and stuff like that. It's proved to be really difficult to get a huge lot of development on HPR done. I tend to be hacking around on things myself, but just a fairly small level, not the big redesign of API level.
Yes, I mean, coming up with ideas is relatively easy. Actually implementing is a time-consuming bit.
Yes.
And certainly, HPR is quite a loose group, but in more formal groups like board of trustees and company boards, and not even that formal, but where people have to come together and get something done and have legal responsibilities. I'm always very much a big fan of, if you're going to suggest something, don't just expect somebody else to do it, suggest it with some idea of how it might be done, and possibly yes, with the idea that if you think it's a really good idea and nobody else is going to do it, then perhaps you should do it.
Of course, the
downside of that is it inhibits people proposing ideas if they think they have to execute whatever idea they come up with. But yes, on the plus side, it stops people coming up with great ideas which require fiendish amounts of time to implement.
Yes. Having worked in schemes where there's a project manager who says, "Oh, what we really need is this," and walks off thinking that somehow has magically made that piece of software come to exist, without really any other thought about resources or people or anything. I think I was working in an environment that wasn't really well set up for that sort of thing. Being a university, universities are not all that brilliant and that type of thing.
I was keeping to mind a website has a big button on it. You press it, and it says "Create World Peace." Very easy to implement that website.
Yes,
a little bit more difficult to get it to do anything.
Yes, the thing that's happening behind it is something's been written to a file. You've had a world peace request on this date at this time, right? That's fine. That's sorted then.
Is world peaceful equals true? Done, job done.
Really, my message regarding documentation and stuff is that I've come up with the thing that lets me make HPR show notes relatively easily, of the type that I tend to do, which are long and long-winded and detailed, and it handles short and punchy as well, but it's not the thing that I originally envisaged, which was something I could hand over to the world and say, "There you go." It's just been personalized to the umpteenth degree, and is weird. And people go, "What is this nonsense? Why would you ever do that?" and stuff. So
yes, but it's still worth hearing it, I think, because even if somebody's reaction is that, what I've done. I mean, this has happened to me before. I mean, I'm not really a software developer as such, not a professional one. I mean, I do obviously write software and have made money from doing it over the years, but I don't regard myself as a professional software developer, just as in somebody who plays cricket on a Saturday isn't a professional cricketer. Mm-hmm. There was an occasion where I'd written this thing, and I think it was I'd used MediaWiki, which is what, you know, Wikipedia was based on. And there was a phase where like every other website had set up with MediaWiki and was doing something. And there was this, it was written in PHP, I think, and there was little hooks you could put into it. So I'd done all these clever things with the PHP, but it quickly, you know, to extract numbers from a database and display them in tables and do some elementary processing to make it more interactive than a usual wiki would be. What we were doing in this project is not so important. Anyway, it quickly became a nightmare. You know, it sounded like a very good idea, but because I was just cobbling it together myself in my spare time sort of thing, it quickly turned into a nightmare to maintain. And then this guy came in into the company, and then the first thing he looked at was this. I asked him to look at it, and he went, "Oh my God, this is awful. How on earth do you maintain this?" And I went, "Actually, I don't really know how to anymore." So he immediately said, "No, this is how you should do it," and then went in and did it much better than I did. You know, so I think that that can happen, can't it? If you share your stuff, show somebody else, and then they realize with benefit of hindsight, your work is then valuable because it can show somebody else. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, and not how they think, "Oh, well, that's what you want done. I see what you want done. I've seen how you do it, but now I'm going to go at it from my way." You know, that can be good.
Yeah, yeah. No, you have a point there. You have a point. I spent a lot of my working life creating things to solve immediate problems, and often they were clunky things that worked, but were not, they were hard to expand and whatever. When I started working at the university, there was no automation that let students get accounts on the central machines. It was a guy who sat in his office all day long, and students came and knocked at the door and said, "Can I have an account on the machine, please?" And he'd say, "Yeah," and he'd sit there and type stuff into some bits of software, and that out would come a bit of paper that said, "There you go, there's your account," and off you go. But we were dealing with, you know, thousands of people and remote people and stuff like that. So I ended up writing a whole, there's a name for these things, but it's an account management system that created all these things. But it was done to my way of doing it. You know, it was a case, "Oh, we need this right, quick. You've got a day to fix it right, it's fixed." And you look back and you think, "Oh my God, what happens if that bit of string breaks and it all falls to the floor?" And I handed that over. When I retired, I spent months explaining how this stuff worked and handing this stuff over, none of which they were going to run. They were going to re-implement it in Oracle thingies. Oracle offer a similar product that lets you hook into your student database and create accounts and give people resources and roles and control and stuff. So, you know, it's a big booming area these days. So there was big handover of knowledge, not of software. It was the knowledge handover that was the useful thing. They didn't listen to everything I said, but they did listen to 90% of it. So that was good.
Well, that is good, because one thing I had my university education at Glasgow, and I've worked there for on and off over the years. And I was quite shocked when I went away, when I left in the 90s, late 90s, everything was done in sort of Linux, Unix systems and lots of clever people that you get in universities who knew about computers, especially in the physics department and some other departments too, including computer science and the computing service itself. I'd come up with like homebrew solutions, and these homebrew solutions were used throughout different, you know, universities, certainly around the UK, some internationally, and I thought it was really good. But when I came back, I didn't work for Glasgow University again until, maybe about 10 years later. When I came back, it was all Microsoft. You know, all this sort of all the stuff that they developed for themselves had gone, and the university had bought in some, I don't know what it was, Teams or something, or whatever, you know, Exchange mail servers and all the rest of it. And I was really quite shocked, you know, to be honest. You know, and of course they were all complaining that they couldn't update things and things weren't working quite the way they wanted it, and they couldn't change it, and the university was paying lots of money. So there's all those grumbles. And I mean, maybe I've got rose-tinted spectacles, but I don't remember seeing that you know, because the people that developed a lot of these systems, like you developed your system, were there at the university, and you could go and talk to them, and you could go and ask them, and you know, and you ended up with something that was much more bespoke to how that university worked. So, yeah, so I was a bit disappointed, but I don't really know enough about it to say how bad or good a thing it was. But it, my instinct was that it wasn't a good thing; it was a bad thing.
Well, they gone down that road. Having been in a university while that process was happening, there was the way that universities were funded changed a lot over my time working there. It used to be central funding for certain particularly computers. I mean, when I started work there in 1981, then all of the central computing facilities were paid for by government through a body set up specifically to do that, and that I think was shut down in the early 90s, that sort of time. I don't remember precisely. They were called the Computer Board, and they had, you know, sort of a fair amount of money. We got £1 million in 1987 to buy our replacement system, which was due to last for 7 years before we get any more funding. So it must have still kept going beyond those 7 years. So it was in sort of mid-90s maybe that the thing petered out. And of course, universities at that point were on their own, you know, use your own budget to buy your computing thingies. And nobody, at least in my experience, who were managing these places knew what the hell to do. You know, the first reaction was, well, bring in consultants. And the consultants came in rubbing their hands with glee because they had this wonderful bunch of people who knew nothing about what they did know a lot about in the main, anyway, at least at the management level. And you know, they bulldozed all sorts of nonsense into the way things were set up. And of course, the answer had to be that you bought stuff from the big boys. You don't go. There was a thing. You know, Simon Phipps. He was working for Sun when Sun went much more open source with their stuff, and then Sun got bought up by Oracle, wasn't it? Yeah, and he left around about that time, and he went to work for a company called ForgeRock. ForgeRock was a company that was making these sorts of account management things like I was describing. So, you know, you had to have a source of who the people were from your HR system or from your student record system, whatever it was. And you fed the data into this system and it spat out whatever you told it to through filters to make accounts and give people access rights and all of that sort of stuff. And we looked, there was a strong recommendation that we look at ForgeRock as the way to do things in the university. But the management would not touch it because, you know, here's this small company making this product, whether it's good or bad, we don't care. But how are they still going to be here next year, you know, 5 years time? Oracle, on the other hand, we know will be there forever and ever and ever. You never get rid of them, you know.
Yes, yeah. Well, yeah, you've got your, yeah, it's like the, you know, people wanting security. Well, being in prison is a pretty secure environment.
That would do it.
Yeah. Oh, we've maybe ventured off into the subject of a future HPR episode there, because that's actually quite interesting. I don't know if it's one that you'd want to talk about more, but I certainly have my you know, my contact with it too, from a different capacity to yours.
Well, yes, I the whole business of how UK universities functioned, well, just from my limited experience of it, though, I was in a managerial role at that time, and I was not happy with the way things were going. So I was quite keen to take the early retirement offered me in 2009 to get out. But one of the things, and I've always hesitated to mention this, but I'm going to mention it now. when you get a deal, but and universities are great at this, they say, okay, we've got all these people. Oh, look, he's an old guy. I was in my 50s at that point. So, oh, and he's earning a fair bit. Right, let's offer him the offer he can't refuse to get out, right? Get your pension starting up early and off you go. And so they come to say this, and they really do put the pressure on. And they say, but before you get your leaving bundle, whatever, your free stapler and stuff, it wasn't that. But then you have to sign this non-disclosure agreement that will prevent you from saying anything nasty about us into the future. So I had to sign this. Oof. And that to me was a strong indication that things were well off the rails in that organization. I was very pleased to get out of it. So me going against this non-disclosure agreement. But you don't know what the university is, do you? So that's fine.
That's true. Yes, we haven't mentioned that. No, indeed not. Well, I do think that, because I have, not personally, but I have friends and indeed my own parents who are somewhat older than you, actually went through something very similar. And a lot of things that you describe are familiar stories that they told me. Mm-hmm. That may be an interesting...
Well, yeah, it would be an interesting thing to talk about. And the whole subject of, if you have a number of employees, which a very large proportion are very skilled, highly motivated, what's your best approach as a manager to keeping them doing what they do well? Do you tell them that they're all a bunch of idiots and not to be trusted, and you're going to build this infrastructure that says, okay, every week you come and report what you did and we score it. And then if you get a low score, then you're very, very naughty and you have to do much better the following week. If you build that sort of a structure for that sort of group of people, then do you get a good result? This is a very interesting question. I'm sure there are many people who are far more skilled in this subject than I am, just being a victim of it, who would comment. Yeah. But you know, it's an interest, and it happens all over the place. I mean, the demotivation of skilled and potentially trustworthy people by failing to trust them and treating them like, you know, cogs in a machine is well known to be a destructive force in the world of work these days.
Indeed, yes. And I mean, the way I viewed it is that kind of practice that you just described, perhaps like target-driven culture of management, it was imported from the commercial world, from what academics like to call industry, everything that's not academia, industry. So commercial companies tried this and it failed. And weirdly, the consultants who are peddling it went into universities.
They did.
I guess, because and sold it to them too, as you described. But anyway, I am going to have to go shortly.
Yeah.
But I do think I'd like to talk more about that in some future episodes.
Yes, so, yes. Yeah. Well, it would be an interesting subject. I dare say there'd be a few people listening who might be interested, might have their own experiences to share as well. As regards the making of books and stuff like that, I think, I don't know, is there any more mileage in this subject? We've covered in general quite a lot of stuff here, so we could just leave it at that point. I don't know if we want to get into any more detail, do we?
No. I think I've said all that I would say in the last episode, and I was enjoyed hearing what you described too. So yeah, no, I think for the time being that's it. But yep. Who knows? I might go off and get some ideas to try, and like those templates are not something I considered using myself, but I think maybe I might.
Well, it would be interesting maybe to revisit this subject months down the road, just to say, you know, we've both taken a different look at the problems that we were kicking around and come up with some different approaches. So let's have a little chat about those. That might be some mileage in that.
Yes, definitely. So I guess all that really remains, unless there's anything else you want to say, Dave, is just to say goodbye and thanks to everyone in HPR for listening.
Yep, that's me. I've finished as well. Goodbye to everybody. And thanks, Andrew. It's been fun having these chats.
Indeed it has.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.